everybody, and welcome back to the Sweet Tea series. My name is Ariana Silva. Today we are at the Texas Policy Summit. So all day long, there have been a lot of speeches, panels, and we have people here from grassroots activists. We have people who are working in the legislative staff, and lots of other people who are just policy experts and enthusiasts. One of those people here today is the host of the Jackie Daily Show, Jackie Deason. Thank you for being here and welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on the show. I love this event.
Oh, and I'm so glad that you're able to be here. So right now, we're going to dive into your amazing bio real quick, because I think people need to know how inspiring you are.
Yeah,
so Jackie is not only the host of a show that's on Blaze Media, she's also worked for an engineering firm that specializes in energy production, national security, and environmental cleanup. She also worked on Capitol Hill with the chairman to the subcommittee on the Constitution, and also prior to her career in D.C., she was a corporate litigator and was the assistant vice president for a national bank. You've done everything, it seems.
I must be older than I look, let's hope. Yeah, I've done a lot of things, packed a lot into these years.
Well, I'm glad that you're able to be on the show today. And one of the things that we're going to be diving into is a lot of your energy expertise, which is one of the main topics for your show, isn't it?
It is, yes.
Okay. And before that, the other thing I didn't even mention, for at one point you were at TPPF as one of our
senior fellows,
yes, with Life Powered.
Yes.
So I'm so glad that we get to have you back and contribute to again with us. So before you got into your whole career going into law, into energy, how did it start out? How did you, what was your, I guess, early life like that inspired you to go down this route?
So I think it's because I grew up in Southern Ohio and to a family that really cared about history and about civic participation. I toured like every historic site and battlefield and, every field trip that a family could take you on, I went, that the grandparents took me, and just taught me to love the country. Mm-hmm. And so I just really didn't want to spend my life doing anything else other than solidifying the rule of law and buttressing and supporting this U.S. Constitution. I think it's the most beautiful governing document ever written, if imperfect, but still it's the best that mankind had come up with and has amazingly kept this place going and in what we are today for almost 250 years. And so I love what I do. I love the law. I love the media. It's all, though, about making the country strong. It is America first.
So what inspired you, because there's so many different ways that you can uphold tradition. Like you said, your grandparents were like intentional about taking you to go learn about history and real life, like be able to have that tangible experience with it. Why did you choose to pursue law as your way of going about engaging with it?
I was from a small town, and so I didn't have a lot of role models around, but those that were there were lawyers. Mm-hmm. And so I loved politics, and I loved going to the courthouse and getting involved with everything where I could intern and work. And I just had a skill set for it. So I was like third in the state in the mock trial competition in high school. And I thought, I'm good at this. So why don't I go to law school? Which was great and exactly the right choice for me. I loved it.
And so what then created a shift? Because you started first with just like corporate sort of stuff. At what point in your life did you realize that you wanted to make a change and move into the government?
I always knew that I wanted to do either politics or policy. But I couldn't afford it right out of school. Like, I was one of these people who, I had full tuition scholarship the first 4 years, but law school was so expensive at Vanderbilt. I felt like the only acceptable choice for the culture there was that you go into a big firm or, a prominent firm that pays well, pay down some debt, and then move on to the government service. So that's what I did. And I think it's good, too, because it legitimizes your experience. I mean, it's much more difficult to go from the firm into the government and then from the government into the firm. And so I just thought like it was a credential and, to go in that direction. I'm glad I did. But I was working in the firm and I remember every day was the same. It's like you wake up, it's parking garage to your desk, desk to parking garage, back home to sleep. Like, it's dark by the time you get to leave the office. I felt like it wasn't like totally fulfilling me. A part of me was dying by not being able to be involved in the national conversation and policy. That's what I really loved. My spirit was dying, so I couldn't just be at that desk. Anyone can do that job and make money, but not everyone's going to care about the work that I did later on Capitol Hill and now on the show.
So what does that work look like that you did on Capitol Hill?
So I was counsel to the chairman of the Subcommittee on the Constitution, which is part of the U.S. House Judiciary Committee. in that committee, which is kind of famous because it's the street fighting committee. It's the roughest, toughest, meanest, and, you know, slangiest committee. I guess we did everything from constitutional law to criminal law, immigration, intellectual property, administrative law, like overseeing the administrative state, voting rights. So just a lot of great stuff. Free speech, just issues that I really cared about, were close to my heart. I got to work on there every day, so I loved it.
How do you transition between those things? Because I feel like, especially as a younger person, I'm still like only 2 years out of college. And when you're looking at all the career that lies ahead of you, sometimes it's hard to think about that you can take steps and move as life moves you. So how did you make that that step from one to the other?
I mean, in my case, and this is a fault, actually, the grass is always greener for me on the other side. So I'm like, I want to be a lawyer. Okay, now I've done this and it's not like as exciting as I thought it would be. Oh, I want to go to Capitol Hill. Oh, this is awesome. But the real power is in talk radio, right? Because I was working on the Hill, and I remember back then the Speaker of the House was a friend of mine, and I would hear him lament out in the hallway, this is governance by talk radio, because Rush Limbaugh and Mark Levin and all these guys would pressure the House Republicans to do what they wanted them to do, pressure their listeners to light up the phone lines on Capitol Hill on various issues. And I was like so amazed by the Speaker being more concerned about talk radio hosts than journalists. And I thought, that's where it's at. And in fact, my personality would only be rewarded on talk radio. Like, I'm not able to muzzle my opinion, so I'm not good in a corporate environment or on Capitol Hill working for like a strict boss where only the boss has an opinion on Capitol Hill. The staff don't get to have opinions. You just support the opinions of the boss. And so I thought talk radio is obviously what I should do next.
It seems like a lot of your experience were like building on top of each other. So you start with the corporate litigation that gives you the skills that you need to do the kind of stuff that you did on Capitol Hill. And then that gave you the information to be able to share your opinions in talk radio. So while you were on Capitol Hill, I think one of the most interesting things that connects to more of the stuff that you talk about now is your research on the foreign influence in climate alarmism. Can you share a little bit about what that research included?
Yeah, so the first thing that happened that shocked me about oil and gas and ever got me interested, because it seemed kind of like a side issue, is that we were doing the War on Terror legislation at that time. And so
set the scene. What year is this around?
This would have been between 2006 when I arrived until 2013. And you find out that so much of the terrorism was funded by oil money around the world, whether it was in Middle East or North Africa or elsewhere. I became interested in how do we fight back against this, because we were so reliant on Saudi Arabia and other countries that could at times be hostile. And so I realized this country has so much oil and gas through the fracking revolution, which was just hitting its stride around 2012 to 2014. This is our chance to break away from our dependence on hostile countries and be the Saudi Arabia of oil, the Saudi Arabia of natural gas, the Saudi Arabia of coal and nuclear. This is our chance. And I just realized that this was like my contribution to what we were doing all that time on Capitol Hill. So then later it was more fully developed when all the fracking bans started across the country in different states and localities. The former chairman of my committee, Judiciary, went to the Science Committee, investigated, and found out that for every, you know, dollar that the Russians had invested in influencing our elections, they had spent 50 cents influencing our oil and gas industry. Pipeline protest, fracking protest, and that's just Russia. And so the Congressional Committee referred this information over to the U.S. Treasury to be investigated. And so then it was finally proven that foreign competitors like Russia, which is a major oil producer and our top competitor other than Saudi Arabia, was investing money to try to shut down U.S. oil and gas, just what we had been talking about. And it's so obvious. I mean, it's not illegal. It's perfectly legal.
I had never heard that ratio before about how much money was being put into that.
That's what the investigation found. And that's just what they located. There could be more.
And was this, I guess this is just like off the tail of the earlier climate alarmism that we were seeing in the United States with, oh my gosh, what's the documentary that was called that came out in the early 2000s?
Oh, you mean Inconvenient Truth?
Yes, the Inconvenient Truth, climate alarmism. So I guess when you're doing all of this, this is on the tail end of all of that sort of propaganda that's circling around the nation. So how does that relate to our national security today?
So we still have the same problem. I mean, you see that our country leadership is constantly making decisions that don't make any sense. Why do we constantly make it harder and harder for American producers to produce. I mean, every regulation that the Biden administration can throw down, they'll throw down. Biden campaigned on ending fossil fuels, whatever that means, which it's impossible, but people bought it. Yeah. And he said it, and he's the president.
Like materials have fossil fuels. How do you have like a tablecloth like this?
Everything on this, everything that you're looking at, this is all made of oil. It's all made from oil.
You can't have a battery-powered tablecloth.
No, it's synthetic materials made from oil.
Yes.
Just like my phone holder, just like the microphone, just like the water bottle, just like your contact lenses, just like your pharmaceuticals. So we can't live a modern life without oil. It's just silly talk. But all of this to say, this still continues. You watch like the Middle Eastern countries host these big climate conferences where countries like ours vow to, you know, murder our oil and gas industry while they are living on just that alone. They are petro-states. This is what they live on, oil and gas. They're hosting these great conferences to call for the end of their own product. No, it's the end of our product. They'll be taking that market share when we're out of the way, if our government can successfully regulate us out of existence, which is what they're after.
So speaking about the foreign influence on this, there was actually a Fox News article the other day, and this is a quote from it. It says, a Chinese green energy firm backed by Michigan state government is tearing down trees to make way for a proposed electric vehicle battery plant designed to help the state meet its climate goals. So what's happening in Michigan with these EVs?
You know, it's a really long story, actually, in Michigan. And I was just reading this coming over to kind of prepare because I'd done a segment on this last year. Basically, imagine this. Here's all you need to know to understand EVs in Michigan. Jennifer Granholm is our energy secretary. Before she was the energy secretary, she was the governor of Michigan. All right. She, while governor, was pushing all of these electric vehicles and buses, including Proterra, a company called Proterra that makes buses that are apparently broken down far more often than normal buses. Bad deal for Michigan. She invested in the company. She joined the board after she left as governor. Then she became energy secretary, and the Republicans in the Senate said, you need to divest from Proterra because you're clearly conflicted. She's like, okay, fine. She sells her stock for a $1.6 million capital gain. Here's what I'm saying. It's obvious, right, that she set this up. Yeah, I'll be the governor, Proterra, that will make sure that you have a guaranteed income from Michigan taxpayers for a suboptimal product. I'll invest. I'll be on the board. I'll make a ton of money. And it's so obvious that that is what is going on. This is why we have these bad deals. This is why you see things that don't make any sense. You have politicians who are more than willing to get wealthy off of a situation. I mean, they make like $172,000 a year, I think, in Congress when I left. Yet they all go in with almost nothing and come out multi-millionaires, maybe more than multi. How does that happen? It happens because it's not illegal for them to behave this way. And so if you are a foreign adversary, you can easily pick these people off that you need in places of influence just by guaranteeing them they're going to be rich if only they'll do what it is that you want. So an electric vehicle company has a supply chain. It basically is controlled by China. It makes perfect sense for the Chinese. This is exactly what I would do if I were China. It's the smartest thing to do. They'd be crazy to not make us reliant on them so that they can then pressure us on policy points. Why not?
It seems to me like some people in the government are almost, blind to threats when it comes to electric vehicles, and they're willing to just push anything through to support electric vehicles. What's going on with that? Or what do you think they see as the appeal to electric vehicles, and what's the truth?
You know, some of it is genuinely that they believe false narratives. So not everybody's a sellout. Not everybody's grifting. And maybe even Jennifer Granholm actually believes in electric vehicles. I don't know the answer to that. Maybe she's sincere in her advocacy. But I just did a video on this with Mark Mills, who's here at Texas Public Policy Foundation, all about how the world is a scarier place because elites believe false narratives. And so there's so much money poured into the campaigns, the PR campaigns, the education campaigns, the lobbying campaigns to make certain policies happen. And the effect of those policies is to redistribute billions of dollars from American taxpayers to the elite connected few, the politically connected few and politicians. And that's what this is about. That's what's happening here. It doesn't make sense policy-wise for Americans or for America, but it makes great sense for them and for the countries that are benefiting.
So you've been, again, you were saying since like the early 2000s, you've been talking about energy and really supporting reliable resources for people. But there's a lot of environmentalists who would attack you and other people who are supporting this, to saying that, oh, you're just shilling for big oil and you're the one who's trying to profit from all of this. What do you say whenever people have those type of comments?
Well, I'm not getting rich on what I do. I don't work for free, but I'm definitely not getting rich on what I do. I would tell you that, listen, no, you just parse out the facts. Like, instead of focusing on whatever it is they're focusing on, what's critically important, we need them to understand the facts, because this is a life or death issue. Like, if we don't produce enough energy, people die by the billions. So for example, I would just interview with Texas Railroad Commissioner Wayne Christian, who I love. And he pointed out, you know, if you use natural gas derived fertilizer to grow our crops, you can feed 12 billion people. If you don't, you can feed 4 billion people. There are 8 billion people. So if we stop using natural gas, a fossil fuel, to make fertilizer, billions of people would die. We don't have a plan for how to replace that. That's just one example of the seriousness of this issue. Or if you don't get it right, then there will be war. Like, historically, many wars are caused either because we're fighting over an energy source like oil or a pipeline pathway, or there was sabotage to infrastructure that was energy related, and that's what determined who won or lost a war. People would tell you, if the Nazis could have got to Baku, Azerbaijan, to that big oil field, maybe it would have gone differently. So these are things that really, really matter. We have to care, and people need to look at those goals and those concerns and get them right. Rather than focusing on who's the messenger, focus on the facts.
Right. I think that there's a lot of times, so when we're talking about like national and international policy, that there's like just the everyday person who's like, this is above me. This is not what doesn't affect my day-to-day life. How do you think it impacts like just your average American taxpayer?
You know, I think the fastest thing that taxpayers will notice immediately is the gas prices on this particular issue, because you drive past the gas station every day. So it's right there in your face. It's just the price that you see changing. The easiest indicator you can see for how things are going, or it's your electric bill. You know what you're paying in the electric bill. Like, Californians pay about 60% more than the average American because of their horrible energy policies. And so people will notice that, but even that is a lot of sleight of hand, because the cost of the unreliable energy like wind and solar is not even in the electric bill. It's hidden in the tax bill. It's coming out of your tax dollars and being redistributed to companies that are producing a product that works part of the time. Like in the Texas freeze, wind tanked down to 1.5% of its capacity, and people don't want to talk about that. Whereas the nuclear plant just keeps chugging right along. Whether there's a winter storm or whether there's a hurricane, nuclear shows up. Unreliable wind and solar are no-shows at the worst times when you need them most. So these are the kinds of facts that people really have to learn and realize the truth about. I know it's hard because you've got very prominent media outlets telling you the opposite. But if you really pull back the layers of the onion and look at the methodology, then you find that what we have always had going for us, what's always been under our feet, our own oil and natural gas, is all we need. Anyway, I don't even have enough time to even begin to scratch the surface of that particular
Well, the good thing
topic.
Is that you have an entire podcast with information about this. TPPF has lots of videos. And actually, there's a senior fellow who's for TPPF right now, Jason Isaac, who
yes.
speaks about energy and other things. But one thing that I liked that he was talking about once was, whenever you're looking at this energy issue, the left really does have this narrative saying that, well, people are just trying to get rich. Whenever we're like dealing with oil policy and stuff, they're just trying to help the oil industry out to get more money. But what he says is really important to note is that when we're trying to create good energy policy to get people access to reliable resources, an oil company that wants to make more money would need the gas prices to be more expensive. So there's just little like logical things like that that I think people have just been for too long trusting what they're hearing versus taking a step back to think about it. And while I was at, so I graduated from UT 2 years ago, and we're like here on the campus again today, but it just reminds me of all of the little things that you've heard from even environmental science class in high school that just stick with you. And so I'm hoping that more Americans can like pause and think through some of these issues by getting engaged with some of the materials that we have.
Yeah, well, I was a strident environmentalist whenever I was a teenager, because I read the news and I believed everything I read when I was 13 years old. And then over time, you realize, wait a minute, wasn't I afraid of a vanishing ozone layer was going to kill us all?
Acid rain.
Yeah.
Yes.
killer bees, saccharin, like all the things that you were afraid of. And then what happened to all of those big fears that terrified me? I actually worried about these things horribly when I was a teenager.
I was scared of acid rain because they show you the pictures of like, this is already happening. Haven't heard about it since.
Right. Mm-hmm. So, you know, these are problems that mankind can solve. Yes, climate change is happening. Yes, humans impact the planet. That's all true. But it's nothing that's outside of our ability to contain or to mitigate. We can handle, we've got this. I'm very confident we've got this.
And there's ways that you can use these natural resources responsibly.
Absolutely.
Yes, yeah. And America does a better job at that than other countries anyway.
You definitely want your energy produced here. It's the cleanest in the world, except maybe Canada. I mean, you know, other than that, you want American energy, not the alternative.
Right. So this isn't the only issue that you speak on. What is it that motivates you to get involved in policy at all and keeps you going every day?
You know, I just feel like we've inherited such an amazing country. I mean, it's historically an anomaly. It's so much sacrifice. It's decades and generations and millennia of development to get us to this point. We had these freedoms and we have this amazing life. And I just want to preserve it for myself, the years I have left, and then for those who came after me, because we've been entrusted with this and we must steward it. Just like we steward the natural resources, it's a duty. It's not an option, it's a responsibility. We're all given a purpose in life and talents and we have to use them. So I don't know what I'd rather be doing.
So I'm not sure if you've heard about this, but there's a way that I guess younger women online are getting involved in the energy movement. So there's a TikTok trend that's going around right now where women are convincing, they're playing a prank, I guess, on the men in their life, be it like their boyfriends, dads, brothers, just like men around them. So they're calling them and saying, hey, I'm not sure if you heard about this place. It's called ExxonMobil, and I'm getting an internship with them. And it's like apparently a 1 week thing. And the guys are like, oh, that's cool. You're going to be working for like the energy company, you know, thinking it's on the business side. And they're like, yeah, it's like I get to go to the ocean and do like, I think there's welding underwater. Did you know about that? And the guys freak out. So for the audience, here's a couple of those examples.
A brand Exxon, the gas or something. I don't know what it's called. They want to pay me $25,000 to oil rig. What even is that?
You'll do it.
What do you mean? I don't even know what that is. And I have to go.
Oil rig. So what do they want you to do with it?
They want me to help oil rig in Texas for a whole week. And okay. I'll wear all the stuff with Exxon on it.
Yeah. An oil rig. Just look up oil rigs. For $25,000 for a week? Yeah, you're going.
No, I'm not doing that.
Aaliyah, you would be. That's a whole semester. I want you to think of that.
Okay.
And like, I'd have to be in like scuba gear, like welding things underwater.
You can do it. I don't. Is it dangerous?
I have no clue. You think
you
I can do it?
We can. Yeah. They're not going to ask you to do something you can't do.
I mean, you're right. I just have to post a few pics from there and make like a TikTok on the oil rig.
Yeah, I think it'll be fun.
Sweet.
So what do you think about this trend? Is that the way that women need to get involved with energy?
Do you know something? There is actually a lady whose name I now forget. I don't think she used a real name. It was like eyeliner in the oil patch or something like that. She literally was a welder out in Midland, Odessa area. And one of the very few lady welders in the oil patch. So literally, there is such a thing as a lady welder. It's not totally crazy, although there are a lot of jobs out there that a woman probably would not be as inclined to do because of literally the upper body strength required to do some of these jobs.
Yeah, I have noodle arms. I'm not going out there.
I'm totally incapable of all of this. But like, no, it was a funny video that you sent. But I thought, you know what? The other thing was the ladies were saying, I want to be an oil rigger. I'm like, an oil rigger, is that like an election rigger? Is that like, a poker game? I mean, they were obviously calling and sounding like they had no idea. Like they've never heard of ExxonMobil. That was a little bit tough to believe. But then I'm a little older now. So maybe the younger generation is not, they don't even drive cars anymore, right? They Uber and Lyft and whatever. But I think it's actually cool. There should be a lot more women in oil and gas. I mean, believe it or not, there are all those blue collar jobs they were talking about in the video. There's all the white collar jobs too. There are a ton of jobs And even now, petroleum engineering is the number one paying degree in America. You get the highest starting salary in petroleum engineering. There are a ton of jobs. It's not in the past industry. It's still awesome. So look into it. If you want a career, it's going to be alive and well for a long time. I don't care what you're being told by Al Gore and John Kerry.
Again, even if we switch to electric vehicles, which, okay, sure, but everything has oil, and we're using that in everything.
Yeah.
Oh, so
yeah.
I definitely agree with that. So let's say that there is the sorority girl out there who's like, oh, this is actually an industry that I'd want to get into. You were saying that there's jobs like that. What are other ways that younger women can get involved with policy?
So you mean energy policy or just policy in general?
Let's say each question. Let's start with energy.
So there's something called the Women's Energy Network. You can find them in just about any energy producing state in the big cities. I'm a member. You can join. They've been on my show many times. And they know all about all the job availability for women in the industry, which is great. Whether you're in HR, you're an accountant, you're an engineer, whatever you do. Or law, they're great. Policy in general, you know what? Go to the Texas Public Policy Foundation website and just navigate around and look around. Almost whatever your issue is now is covered at Texas Public Policy. It used to be just a handful of issues long ago, but now it's grown into this massive, largest think tank in the country at the state level. So just browse and look for something that motivates you.
Well, I did not prep her to say that, but thank you for having the right answer. That is the correct answer. So the other thing that you have a lot of expertise in, you obviously went to law school. So if there's a college age person right now who's considering a career in law, what are things that they can be doing now to set themselves up for success?
I would say this. I would say only go to law school if you really love studying and you love the law. I do, and I did. And so I think it's wonderful. There are a lot of people who go to law school who I think really shouldn't and who regret it later. So I would say go apprentice, right? Go to a law firm. Find a law firm that will let you work for them for the summer in an internship or something like that, and just lay your eyes on it and really get to see what it looks like. Because it's a really tough world. If you're going to work in a big firm, it's a tough lifestyle. You don't have a lot of work-life balance. But there are alternatives. I mean, there are many ways you could be a lawyer. But most of the time, at least, people I went to law school with, they all went to the big firms, and they burn out. And then they end up becoming a general counsel for a company. Just circulate around while you're young and you have no restraints, no kids, no big obligations. Sample all these different places you'd love to work and figure out what you love. Do what you love and you'll never go to work a day in your life. Like, I love the show. I love what I do. I love volunteering. We do a ton of stuff in Dallas with nonprofits, as you know. So just make sure that your life counts, and you're going to put it to the 30-year test. What are you going to want to say 30 years from now that you accomplished? What kind of life do you want? Just make it. Just create it. Just dream it and draw it. Just be it.
I'm glad that you brought up the thing of actually just trying it out through internships. So right now I'm one of the filmmakers at TPPF. But back in college, my parents were okay with me doing the film degree because they're like, oh, that's fine. You'll just go to law school afterwards. I would not have been happy as a lawyer. But one summer, just to prove to my dad, no, I'm not doing this. I did intern at a law firm. Loved the group. They did it was mostly family, a little bit of civil stuff and just wills and estates. Mm-hmm. I actually loved the wills and estates portion. It was people who I kind of knew coming in all the time. But the family law, I was sad every single day going home.
Absolutely.
But yeah. I'm glad that I got that experience and got to see it. And so I have friends who, whenever they say that they want to go to law school, it makes so much sense for their personalities, the kind of things they do.
Right.
But I'm glad that I got that experience so I could say, oh, this isn't for me.
Right. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And what have you got to lose? It's great experience. All work experience is good experience. I know now, as someone who employs or have employed other people, the value of just having to show up every day, be part of a team, be part of a hierarchy, learn to work with the boss, learn to work with subordinate, just no matter what you're doing, just get the experience. It's better than the schooling I have found with the people that I've worked with often, and I'm hearing more and more people say that. The degrees aren't as valuable as you show up on time, you have a great attitude, you work hard, and you can learn, and we can teach you. I mean, everyone has value. People in the past put way too much stock into, I don't have a college degree, so I don't bring value. That's not true.
Yeah, I think even companies like Daily Wire, because some of their, I think it's Jeremy Boring who doesn't have a college degree. Okay. And so they were just talking about how they, whenever they're hiring, they stopped requiring that as a necessity. So whenever people are going to college, and for my friends who are still in college now, I really encourage them, go do the degree, use that as like to build up your network and stuff like that. But you need to be trying to do as many little jobs as you can throughout the year to be able to build up that experience.
I think it's awesome. Yes. Yeah. Just work. Just get started somewhere and work your way to where you're happy.
Yeah. So if people want to learn more about you and find your show, where can they find you?
Find me online 24/7 at JackieDaily.com. That's Jackie with no E, daily like every day.com. And from there, you can follow me on the X at Jackie Daily Host, or on Facebook or Instagram or Truth, and continue to connect with me and communicate with me there.
So we can find you everywhere, across industries, all over the internet.
You know what? On The Blaze, on Spotify, on iHeartRadio, on Google, all the major podcasting outlets, I'm there. And also in West Texas, in the Permian Basin, on The Dial. I'm actually on the radio in the Permian Basin, the largest oil patch in America. So yeah, lots of places to find Jackie Daily.
Thank you so much for taking your time out of Texas Policy Summit to come and speak to me today.
Thank you for the invitation.
Good luck with everything with your show. And I feel like I'm getting a new mentor out of this as well.
Oh,
so
good.
Thank you.
Good. Well, you have a new friend. So absolutely.
Oh,
very nice
to
meet you. And thank you for having me.
And to everyone back at home, thank you so much for joining us. I hope you get to see some of the Texas Policy Summit stuff online. Everything's on our website. Again, thank you all so much for joining us, and happy Friday.